91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we explore mental health and the Florida prison system. It's estimated that some 60% of inmates have mental disorders. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Last month, the Miami-Dade Commission discussed constructing a new mental health diversion facility, but many are still outraged by abuses and confirmed deaths within the system. The death of inmate Darren Rainey at Dade Correctional Institution is at the forefront of the controversy. It sparked a lawsuit by an advocacy organization. We'll speak with former Florida correction psychotherapist George Mallinckrodt. He's written a book about his experiences in the system. Also, we'll have Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown on hand. That's next, Topical Currents, after the news. And 7 minutes before 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman on this Wednesday afternoon. George Mallinckrodt is a psychotherapist who worked at Dade Correctional Institution from 2008 to 2011. He was terminated. He recently published a book called Getting Away with Murder, which preceded the notorious 2012 death of inmate Darren Rainey. And we'll hear George Mallinckrodt's story shortly.
Also with us is Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown. She's followed and written about troubles at the Florida Department of Corrections, Darren Rainey, and a lawsuit against DOC filed by a group of advocates. Welcome to you, Julie Brown.
Thank you.
Okay. Julie, the Herald reported the story of Darren Rainey. Were you the first to report that story?
Yes, we were.
And it took nearly 2 years for that to happen. How did you learn about it, and why did it take 2 years?
Well, we received several letters from an inmate at the prison, Harold Hempstead. He had been haunted by this story ever since it happened. He had been afraid to speak out about it prior to that time because he was at that prison, and he thought there would be retaliation against him if he spoke out. So he waited until he got transferred or felt in a safer place that he wouldn't be retaliated against, and he began writing letters to the Miami Herald about it, and also sending us documentation of some of the complaints that he had forwarded to the FDOC's Inspector General describing the events that happened to Darren Rainey. And they were just so chilling and so detailed with so many names, and it just seemed like something we needed to look into because there was too much detail for someone to have made up something like that.
And it was such a horrible death, to be scalded to death in a shower, allegedly for punishment for soiling his cell. Is that correct?
Well, we don't really know. The medical examiner hasn't issued a ruling on the cause of death. But
after 2 years, there's no medical examiner's ruling.
No, and we, you know, all indications are that this case was not treated as a possible homicide from the get-go. It was treated as a death, in custody death, and it wasn't really seriously investigated either by police or the medical examiner.
By the way, before we go on, I want to, for the record, our Topical Currents producers contacted representatives of the Florida Department of Corrections. We invited them to participate this hour, but they did decline to participate. Bonnie?
Okay, Julie, I was just going to say, you said he also forwarded his letters to the FDOC, and they did nothing.
Well, they would send them back just cursory responses saying you haven't provided enough information, or we are looking into this, that kind of thing. But of course, this is 2 years later, and after receiving the documents which we requested upon deciding we were going to launch an investigation ourselves into this, we realized that there was very little done on the part of FDOC to look into what happened.
What is the main thrust of the lawsuit filed by Disability Rights Florida? Its main thrust, and also Holland and Knight is also involved in that suit. Is that correct?
That's correct. The main thrust is really not monetary. It's really to get an injunction to get a judge to, quite frankly, order them to do a lot of things differently with the mentally ill and their care than they are now. They live in conditions that are quite, you know, quite awful. Air conditioning problems there where these inmates don't have air conditioning, plumbing, leaking roofs. I mean, George can talk about this. Mm. I'm sure he's seen the conditions firsthand.
And it's a little south of Homestead, so it's definitely hot in the summer.
Yeah, out in the Everglades. And it's a terrible situation. I mean, they're already suffering from mental illness. And to have them in these sweatshops, so to speak, and really confined for a good portion of their day is just something that I think that they would like to change.
Let's bring George Mallinckrodt into our conversation. George, I just thought maybe we'd begin with a little of your background. You were a psychotherapist and with the Dade County Public Schools prior to this.
And private practice.
Yes. With Dade County, I worked with Bertha Abbas Children's Center. I counseled severely emotionally disturbed and emotionally handicapped children in a middle school setting.
Yeah, your stories of them were pretty horrible, too. And then they closed that.
Well, as we know, the school system ran out of money. And so all the private contractors were essentially fired along with their employees. So
what made you want to work as the mental health specialist in the psychiatric ward?
I actually didn't. It was an economic decision because as you know, the recession was in full swing and there were very few jobs out there. So when the prison offered me a job, I thought, you know, how bad could it be?
Now, was that with the prison or was it an outsourced mental health service?
It was Corizon. Actually, it was another company before Corizon. And they offered me the position of mental health specialist.
So what did your job entail, and how would you generally describe your patients?
The job entailed doing individual counseling, group counseling. My patients committed a wide range of crimes. I think I counseled every single variety of crime imaginable, from people who were there for life for first-degree murder to people who were there for drug possession and they may have had a very short sentence. I counseled child molesters, rapists, bank robbers, grave robbers, pretty much covered it all.
And what kind of psychiatric disorders?
Well, it ranged from pretty much your basic depression. Prison is definitely not a happy place to be. Anxiety, paranoia. I had a lot of people on my caseload that were severely delusional, paranoid schizophrenics, people that basically, you know, in retrospect, we wondered, how did these people end up in prison? People that were so chronically mentally ill that the staff, we just were shaking our heads constantly.
Well, that's my question. Why were they in prison?
I think it's a combination of things. As there was less and less funding for community mental health facilities or mental institutions, those places closed down. So the mentally ill were left to basically fend for themselves. And some of these people couldn't hold down a job. They had no place to live. So they might get picked up for petty crimes, shoplifting, breaking into homes. I mean, they're just trying to really survive.
Right.
And so then they end up in the system.
Julie Brown, did you find that the mental patients that were there to be warehoused, essentially? There was nowhere else to go.
Yeah, I think that even, you know, on a local level, the police departments locally don't really know what to do with these people when they, you know, as George mentioned, there isn't any other alternative sometimes than to put them in jail. I mean, they are, in some cases, a danger to other people because of their mental state. So I think that, as I mentioned, I think that local police and authorities aren't really trained or have the option to send them any other place when they do commit even a minor crime.
George, you talk about how this affected your own mental health working there. in a way. I mean, you became a different person, basically, did you not?
Most definitely, most definitely. It seemed that there would be a pall that would come over me every day, and I couldn't find a way to get past that. Family and friends noticed that I became darker, and I just quite frankly just kept going and going and going, and from an early part of my tenure, I knew I had to get out. But I had no place to go. There were no jobs, so I was in a really bad situation of just having to soldier on.
Just how big was your caseload? Was it overwhelming?
It wasn't really overwhelming. I might have anywhere from 30 to 35 inmates, and we were required to see them every other week. When they came in initially, we saw our new intakes of 4 weeks in a row, and then they went on the schedule for every 2 weeks. So it wasn't overly demanding. In fact, I'm extremely efficient with what I do, and I was able to basically do the 40-hour-a-week job in about 25 hours. And I had a lot of free time on my hands.
What were those sessions typically like?
Well, for the inmates who were capable of coming out and actually being in a room to have a session, sometimes they were very generic in a sense. It would be, you know, hey, what's going on with you? And then I would see the same issues time and again. It'd be,
and they had to be there.
Yeah. Well, they were required, but they could refuse psychotherapy. And the same things kept coming up time and time again. What's happening in their family? The guards are missing with their head. The food is horrible. They've got an appeal going. It's not like when I was counseling out in the world where somebody would come back a week later and any number of things could happen. So it was a very small range of events.
When did you become aware of the abuse that was taking place? How early on?
You know, when I first got there, they may as well just drop me off on another planet. I was completely out of my element. And I was seeing abuse, but I wasn't categorizing it as abuse. I saw harsh cell searches where inmates' property was destroyed. They would throw their radio in the toilet. They would rip up family photos. And I'd think to myself, oh, wow, this is prison. This is a tough place to be. I didn't see it as abuse. And so then it wasn't really until a couple of years later when the inmate was beaten that I got more attuned to what abuse really is and the whole spectrum of abuse.
We need to take a break. We're speaking with George Mallinckrodt. He's the author of Getting Away with Murder. It's a true story. And also Julie Brown is a journalist and with the Miami Herald, a reporter with the Miami Herald. A short break and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're talking with Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown. Also, George Mallinckrodt is a psychotherapist and the author of Getting Away with Murder, A True Story. And by the way, the official book launch of Getting Away with Murder is this Sunday, November 2nd. It's at Books and Books in Coral Gables at 6 p.m. So, George, just getting back to the abuse for a minute, you say that more often than not, your attempts at actually helping your patients were thwarted by unit protocols, lazy guards, and the indifference of the Department of Corrections itself. Would you explain that?
Well, specifically when it came to the guards themselves, many of the people on my load were sabotaged. And to give you an example, I was working with a schizoaffective who isolated himself, and that's a typical feature of schizoaffectives. And I managed to get him to not only come out for individual therapy, but group therapy. He was going to rec. He started to read. He started to engage in as many opportunities as the unit afforded. One day he was going out to rec, and apparently guards took issue with something he had in his pocket, and he resisted. And the story was that these two guards had probably outweighed him by 250 pounds, grabbed him, smashed him to the concrete floor, opened a gash in his forehead that required a number of stitches. And from that point forward, he, for at least a month, wouldn't talk to me at all. And then some weeks after that, he was out in the day room. They were taking him to medical. And I walked over and I said, you know, how are you doing? You know, what's happening? He made a sudden move. He lowered his shoulders and he ran right into me, and he knocked me back. He knocked me in the chest and knocked me back several feet. So, you know, for my efforts, an inmate attacked me. And I've got to attribute that to the guards.
So was there any structure in place for him, for example, to report abuse? Or is there too much fear, the culture of fear, that no one would report this? And did you report it?
I reported the beating. But as far as inmates reporting abuse, the only way they can do that are through grievances. And quite frankly, those are about as valuable as toilet paper. Mm. I've never seen any grievance seriously taken. And but they do report it.
But the other problem with grievances is when they do report grievances, they're often these inmates are often retaliated against.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because they have to hand them to the very guards sometimes that they're complaining about. I hear stories all the time about grievances that they're sending, that they allegedly write, that aren't on the book, so to speak, because they get thrown away, essentially.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So under what circumstances were you fired from there?
Well, by the point I was fired, a couple months earlier, I'd reported the beating of an inmate by guards. They had taken him to the hallway where there were no cameras, cuffed him up, threw him to the ground, and just started kicking him. And I found out about it in my anger management group. He pulled up his shirt. There were bruises all over. I filed reports not only in Tallahassee with the Inspector General's office, but in the prison itself. From that, I met with Jerry Warden, who was subsequently fired recently.
Jerry Cummings.
Cummings.
Okay. Yeah, Jerry Warden.
The Warden.
Yeah. And so he asked me to do more incident reports as I heard of abuse around the unit. So I started to do these reports. Then the inmates, hearing that I was the go-to guy, started just crushing me with an avalanche of abuse stories, not only in the unit, but around the state. And so I was feeling the pressure there. And as I named the guards in these reports, I started getting dirty looks. My stress level went through the roof. And so my coping strategy, and you know, psychotherapists are always looking for coping strategies,
right,
was to take ever longer lunches. And that's what they got me on. And quite frankly, I thought, if I don't get out of here for some length of of time during the day, I'm not going to last.
Julie Brown, the Florida Department of Corrections has had an ongoing investigation of these allegations through Secretary Michael Cruz. What is the status of that? What have they uncovered? Has it been meaningful?
Well, we don't really know exactly what they're doing. They as much as the secretary has launched all these campaigns for reform in the system and pledged transparency, we know very little as far as what they're accomplishing and what they're doing, because they, you know, every now and then there'll be some people who are fired, but for the most part, the details of what they're doing is really kept under wraps. They really don't tell us much about these investigations. In fact, they do it under the umbrella of this is an ongoing investigation, so therefore we don't have to give you any information on it.
So that's how they keep reporters from really getting
that, and also these documents, if you don't give them the exact wording of the exact name of the exact document, they'll say, well, we don't have that information because you didn't request it in the right format or the right wording of the right document. So it's sort of like this little game that they play, batting back and forth, trying to get the right information. And it could take months sometimes to get documents that we want for involving some of these cases.
Has the federal government gotten involved at all?
Well, we know that the Justice Department is involved in a couple of investigations, isolated investigations involving corruption in a couple of prisons. But for the most part, we don't really see them getting involved in a comprehensive way involving these, even though we believe, anyway, from what we have seen, that there is a pattern here, a systemic pattern of abuse and problems within the system.
I know of one investigation at Suwannee Correctional Institution. FBI agents came in and interviewed inmates. However, I know from relatives who have people there that they said the guards coached them and said, listen, if you say anything to those FBI agents, there's going to be hell to pay. Aye. And so the FBI agents came in for the dog and pony show.
Right.
And they left with whatever conclusions they have. But you can be sure those inmates stayed silent.
What about this audit ordered by Michael Cruz? Why was that ordered? Do you think it was because of your investigation that he ordered?
Well, there's no way of really knowing. But, I mean, it's obvious it's an election year. The heat is really on Tallahassee with the governor's race, particularly since it's so close race. And I do know that there was a lot of people that were worried about these stories and how it would impact the governor's race. So it seemed prudent for him to announce that they were going to review this, especially in light of the fact that we had been reporting that their reports on use of force — this is any time a guard uses force against an inmate or an inmate uses force against a guard — have really increased like 90% over the past 5 years. So they have done a recent audit, I'm told, and it's increased again. So they could see where this was going. And I think that he decided that probably they should take another look at what they're doing.
But in one of the articles I read, in the last 3 months since your investigation, evidently the excessive force incidents have gone down.
Yes, compared to during that 3 month summer period where use of force traditionally, they said, goes up, it did go down slightly during that 3 month period. But overall,
right.
With the fiscal year, it being at what it is, it's gone up.
You mentioned the close governor's race. I don't believe this has been a campaign issue in that race.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I certainly get a lot of mail from people that are disturbed about what's going on, and mail from people who have written the governor about this issue. I think it's really hard to say how much it'll impact it. But I do know, because I've heard from people in Tallahassee that he's been nervous about everything that's happened. The Darren Rainey case in particular got an awful lot of play. And then the recent death at Lowell involving a woman who had written letters to her relatives saying that a guard had threatened to kill her. And then she shows up, like 24 hours later, she's dead. That got national attention. So I think that anything like this on a tight governor's race could impact some voters.
You know what I wanted to ask you? That LaTondra Ellington case that you were just talking about, this Sergeant Q, you wrote, I guess it was you who wrote, that he has this criminal record. I mean, he'd been arrested. It's like he has a rap sheet. How was he made, how was he hired as a sergeant or a guard in Lowell?
Well, obviously, they're not doing really a good background checks on these officers. From what I understand, it's very hard for them to keep corrections officers. I mean, as George, I was thinking this when George was mentioning how difficult it was for him to work there. You can imagine how difficult it is for these officers that are hired in. And anyone who is really educated or has some chance of getting out and getting a better job is going to leave. So the only ones that are really left are officers that can't go anywhere else, probably because they have some kind of a checkered past. And we are finding with some of the cases that we've investigated involving these deaths, the officers involved do have either they have a criminal past, or they at least have been arrested. Maybe they weren't convicted,
right.
Or they have domestic abuse issues. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of issues in their past.
That was a horrible case, that LaTondra Ellington mm-hmm. case. Okay, we're going to take another short break. We're speaking with George Mallinckrodt. He's a psychotherapist, and he's written Getting Away with Murder, a True Story. Also with us is Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown.
And we're back with today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, psychotherapist George Mallinckrodt, formerly of the Dade Correctional Institution, and also Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown. If you'd like to join in our discussion, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. George Mallinckrodt, do you expect to be called to testify in this ongoing lawsuit?
I spoke to one of the principal attorneys, and he said if it does wend its way through the system, I might be called to testify. And I can certainly testify to the abuses that I saw.
Was Darren Rainey under your care?
No, he wasn't. I had already been 10 months fired when that happened to him, and just looking at the timeline, soon after I left, they started to scald these inmates in the shower, which I would call torture.
How did they have control over the temperature, the water temperature in the shower?
Well, it was broken.
It was a broken shower. I've actually seen photographs of it. It was rigged kind of from an adjoining kind of mop closet, janitor closet.
Most of those
types
of showers and institutions have a built-in protection on them.
Well, this, as I think we mentioned before, this facility is in terrible straits. I mean, they had the locks that were broken, air conditioning doesn't work, leaks, all over the place, ceilings that were down, a foot above an inmate's head because it was falling. The kitchen was so bad that the auditors that did an audit on it basically almost condemned it because it was filled and infested with vermin and with roaches. And so this facility was in terrible condition. So imagine, you don't have plumbing that doesn't work. I heard at one point that the maintenance people were taking parts from one sink and putting it in another sink. I mean, they were moving parts around because they didn't have the adequate parts to fix everything comprehensively. So they were able to rig this particular shower using a hose, and they just kind of stuck the hose through the wall. This is like a closet. The shower is almost really like a closet in and of itself, so they just sort of stuck a hose through the wall, connected it to the shower, the top of the shower, and then basically they were able to control the temperature from this mop closet.
Yeah, that was actually, I've seen how it is. There are access panels wherever there is any plumbing in the breezeway that these cells and also the shower are located. So they unscrewed screws to take this panel off, and then they could control the shower from the shutoff valve inside that access panel. And I know from having worked there and tried to wash my hands in a sink that only had hot water, it was brutally hot.
With the circumstantial evidence, why wasn't the Miami-Dade Police Department involved in the death investigation?
They are. They were called in from the very beginning. They had homicide investigators there from the day that he died. The problem is when you do any kind of an investigation, you have to treat it as suspicious, or you should treat it as suspicious from the get-go. That means saving the 911 tape. It means making sure that the area where the person died is completely sealed off and can't be contaminated by anything else. And it's pretty clear that they didn't do that. They didn't treat it as a suspicious death from the beginning, because that these guards were able to even order an inmate that night or early the next morning to clean up the pieces of skin that Rainey had had fallen from his body. And basically he collected it all, put it in a shoe, and asked the guards, what do you want me to do with it? And the guards said, throw it away. Well, that should have never happened in any kind of a police investigation.
George, how did you hear about his death?
I answered the phone as I typically do, and it was my former coworker, and she blurted out, "They killed him!" And I was stunned, and then she filled me in on all the details that came out in Julie's story, and I was appalled.
You said that you felt in many ways like his death was your fault.
I tried to do the best that I could possibly do to bring to light the abuses that I saw when I worked there. And I feel like I just didn't do enough. The supervisor and site manager for Corizon Health Incorporated essentially signed off on a report that said that my coworker didn't see the beating of the inmate. I mean, it was a cover-up. And I should have been stronger in my response. I should have pointed to her and said, hey, by DOC rule, we have to report abuse. What are you going to do about it? I mean, I should have just really stepped up my efforts then. But the situation was so alien to me, I really didn't know what to do. I had no guidelines.
So you're still haunted by this?
I am.
Has this book helped you in any way? How did the book come about?
The book came about as a result of really hearing about Darren Rainey. And I happened to be dating a woman at the time who had written a memoir. And her writing coach encouraged me to write the book. And I wanted to distance myself from the whole thing. But I thought about it and I started writing about it. I thought, okay, no one's listening to me. I reached out to FBI agents. I sent a complaint into the Department of Justice. I called the ME's office and got the report's still pending. I called the Miami Dade police, and I was getting nowhere. So I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to write a book. People are going to learn about this one way or another.
Let's take a couple of phone calls. If you'd like to join in the discussion with George Mallinckrodt and reporter Julie Brown, that number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. And we have Steve from Miami. He's on the line. Hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good.
This is a general question for anybody that's on the panel. Living in Miami for so many years, I've seen and heard so much corruption from DOC, politicians, et cetera. So my question basically is, what's going to happen? Who cares? And at the end, this is not a celebrity. This is not a high-profile person that had a family with lots of money. It's consistent with an inmate or another piece of trash that's now off the street and not part of the taxpayers' money. So when the continued publicity of this goes on and on, what's the end result going to be? I mean, the government's going to change hands, new governor or the same governor. It's evident by Mr. Mallinckrodt that nobody's listening, nobody cares. So what can be done to make somebody care and make people actually, be held accountable from the top down? I mean, if this was somebody that was a beautiful white girl or a politician's family or something, it'd be a whole different. thing. But the reality is all the time, effort, and money that has been spent, and Mr. Mallinckrodt's wonderful expose that he wrote, you know, at some point in time, it's going to be yesterday's news, and, you know, Mr. Mallinckrodt's got to live with it, and unfortunately, I'm wondering, does he have any concerns about his own safety also, or does Ms. Brown, because they're pursuing this injustice?
Well, let's ask them.
Well, that's my own safety has definitely crossed my mind on a number of occasions, and I'm looking over my shoulder. I mean, correctional officers have guns. They've done horrible things. Julie and I, we're working to get this story out, which addresses the caller's question. We want to educate people as to what's happening in the Department of Corrections, but even to the larger issue of the treatment of the mentally ill in our society as a whole and how much it's costing us even locally to have these people on a revolving door in and out of jails and prisons.
Julie?
Well, I agree with what George said, and also think about what's happening here is that we're ending up spending a lot more money to fix a broken system, it seems, you know, putting a lot of Band-Aids in a lot of different places when in reality it's really not doing a whole lot. And I think that unless the public starts holding elected officials accountable, and also, quite frankly, some of these people in elected positions such as state attorneys, I mean, they certainly have the ability to get involved in some of these cases, and you know, a question has to be raised on how many times they sort of look the other way.
What is this that I heard about the commission approving this new mental health diversion facility? What's that, and what's the status of that?
Well, the secretary is hoping to reform the way that they do care and confine mentally ill inmates. And but again, I think that you know, you can announce these big with a flourish, these
right.
big press releases saying we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and I'm not saying that this isn't a step in the right direction. It could very well be a step in the right direction, but I think that you have to look at the bigger problem here, and the bigger problem really is the fact that the state is not putting enough money into this into the corrections department, that they're almost starving the corrections department. Some people have even accused the governor of doing this on purpose so that he could say, well, our public, you know, prison system is failing, so therefore we need to privatize everything. And as we know, it's a very controversial topic and one that, you know, I think the governor would like to see happen. And, you know, there's a lot of powerful companies that private prison companies that would like to make some money here in Florida, and they're pumping a lot of money, I'm sure, into the governor's race and into local elections.
We're speaking, that was the voice of reporter Julie Brown with the Miami Herald, also George Mallinckrodt, a psychotherapist and the author of Getting Away with Murder, and we'll take our last break. We'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with George Mallinckrodt and Julie Brown. For those who didn't hear the beginning of the program, for the record, our Topical Currents producers contacted representatives of the Florida Department of Corrections to invite them to participate this hour, but FDOC declined to participate. Let's go to some more calls. And we'll move along to Natalie. She's in Pembroke Pines. Hi there.
Hi there. Going to the point of what he experienced in the facility, I also think that it also starts in the beginning when people get arrested. It's been a very sad story of someone that I know in a wheelchair got beaten up by officers making fun of someone in a wheelchair because they did not trust. He was in a wheelchair, and all happened for expired license. I believe that it's in the beginning of the process when someone is faced with the officers and every agent that has authority, that there are corrupted people out there. And it's really sad because no one believes it and no one really understands it until you live it you live it and you feel that there's no justice. There's no justice at all. They just take the word, whatever the officer says. You know, it could be vice versa. But the reality is that if you have proof and you have seen this person being up, and then you deny, oh no, you were not beaten up by an officer, it's really sad. It's really sad how life is. And but it's just if there was a voice that everyone can gather and, you know, and go out there and help those that are mentally, you know, and those that are being abused. And it all starts when they encounter an officer. It could be a correct officer or it could be a corrupt officer. And that is the point that we don't know exactly who we're going to face out there and what can happen and what can trigger and, you know, what will be the end result. There's a lot of people out there in facilities that are serving time for no reason. And it's just that it just happens because their word is more powerful than that reality.
Any comment, Julie Brown?
Well, it's true. I mean, before I embarked on this project, I was covering a lot of stories involving police making arrests based on racial profiling and, you know, throwing a lot of people in prison who maybe committed very minor offenses such as loitering and repeatedly arresting the same people over and over in poor areas, in areas that have a high minority population. And, you know, it does go to some degree back to the street level where, you know, we have to really rethink the way that we handle people from the time that they are arrested until and they enter the justice system until the time they actually go to prison and really evaluate whether some of these crimes are worthy of such long sentences in state prison.
Well, George, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was just going to ask you about spam, but go ahead.
Another issue that I've become aware of as I've spoken to parents is that the way the mentally ill are handled, not only in our jails, but in our prisons, is counterindicated for their symptoms. For example, this one young guy, he was remanded into custody from jail. He had no medication in jail, and he was diagnosed bipolar. So they throw him into a reception center with all the other inmates. So he's coming in traumatized. He decompensates, gets into a fight with another inmate. Then by DOC protocols, he's sent off to basically solitary. In this one individual's case, he was in solitary for over a year. That is so counterindicated for somebody with bipolar or schizophrenia. When he came out,
solitary is 23 hours a day. You get 1 hour for exercise,
right,
and that's it.
Right. And when he came out, he was catatonic for months. So what I propose is that the prison system have a dedicated reception unit for the mentally ill so they can get a psych evaluation immediately, get on medication immediately, get counseling immediately to address these.
And the figures show it's about 60% of Florida inmates do have mental disorders. Is that mm-hmm. correct?
That's correct.
And I guess some of them get them while they're there.
Yeah.
Tell us about your work with SPAN. What is it and what is your role there? It's an acronym.
SPAN is for Stop Prison Abuse Now, and it was started by a local mental advocacy group. And basically, they were so motivated by the Darren Rainey killing that they put out a petition, and it's got over 200,000 signatures. And about a month ago, we all went down to Catherine Rundle's office and met with her.
State attorney.
Yes, mm-hmm. state attorney. And met with four of her assistant state attorneys. And they filled us in on what had been happening in the Darren Rainey case. And Catherine Rundle didn't hear about Darren Rainey until Julie Brown's story broke. And one of the assistant state attorneys was telling us why. And on the original report, Darren Rainey's death was classified as an in-custody death of natural causes. When I heard that, I burst out laughing. I couldn't control myself.
So what else is SPAN doing? I mean, so this Stop Prison Abuse Now, do they reach into, do they network out into...
Absolutely. Members of SPAN are people that are on Amnesty International. We're in touch with the local ACLU. We're behind any effort to bring to light these abuses.
And are you making other efforts? You said you have recommendations that would reduce inmate abuse, just such as putting psychiatric patients, you know, having them die, getting a psych evaluation immediately,
right,
and having
so
them
is
separated.
There sort of a, can there be a sort of a triage panel that on incoming prisoners to decide where they should go and how they should be treated?
Well, not even a panel. I believe just a good psychiatrist,
right,
who can do a diagnosis right on the spot. As far as other recommendations, it seems completely obvious that we need cameras everywhere in the DOC. However, we need a separate agency to oversee that with people in the prison.
That's very important.
And
I
who
think
would
that's
that be?
The one thing, because there is a lot of common threads with these cases involving inmate abuse and violence, and a lot of it is guards who seem to be able to not only avoid the cameras, but also to play with the cameras. I mean, I've heard stories where, you know, constantly we're hearing someone, for example, LaTondra Ellington, she was supposedly in confinement. There should have been a camera there. So where's that footage? I don't know where that footage is, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if they end up saying, well, the camera wasn't working. It didn't, you know, the film it wasn't turned on, or there's always some excuse for them not having the cameras. And
well, George mentioned the beating in the hallway.
Has been purchasing cameras. The problem is they're going to have the same people monitoring those cameras.
Right.
So it's like a regulatory agency needs to be set
it's like
up.
Like the fox to guarding the hen.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So something has to be done. A separate agency that does not answer to the DOC.
Yeah.
And the other subject that they could handle too are the grievances.
Mm-hmm.
The DOC is not doing a good job with grievances. And the other thing I'm hearing from parents is that legal mail, which shouldn't be opened, is being destroyed in the prison. The outgoing legal mail that names officers that have abused inmates is being destroyed.
I wrote down this name, Julie, but I don't remember why when I was reading your articles. Gustavo Mazora. I thought that was really interesting, like, about him.
Is he the warden at Lowell?
Yes,
I can't recall.
Or
he's a warden at Lowell where LaTondra Ellington, where she died. And he had sort of a checkered past involving a relationship with a fellow guard under his, a subordinate officer under his command. And she ended up dying. And they think she essentially committed suicide. But it was sort of a messy, torrid kind of affair involving them. And he was, you know, it's typical when there's some questionable activity by some of these wardens or even lower level DOC officers, often they just get transferred around. They don't really have disciplinary action taken against them. They just get moved around.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, if they ever get fired or ever get disciplined.
It seems the pattern that I'm seeing is the ones that get fired are the ones that want to make change or won't do the bidding of some of these other corrupt officers. Those are the ones that end up getting fired, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. George, did you want to add something to that?
Well, I think the turnaround for the DOC is going to take about 20 years. And the reason for that is it's multi-generational. These officers that first come in, they see the abuse. And if they become a part of it, well, then that's almost like an initiation. Then they get promoted. They become the sergeants, the lieutenants, the majors, the captains. So on up the top, these people are just riddled. I mean, the DOC is riddled with people.
Right.
And the Books and Books appearance.
Books and Books, yes. That's the voice of George Mallinckrodt. He's written Getting Away with Murder, and he will launch his book this Sunday, November 2nd, at Books and Books in Coral Gables at 6 p.m. And we wish you well with your book, George.
Thank you.
And reporter Julie Brown with the Miami Herald, we thank you so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's edition. We hope you enjoyed it. It was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives of this and other Topical Currents programs at our website, that's WLRN.org. And more information, links, and discussions at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is about food waste. From farm to distributor to grocery store to table, one-third of human consumable food is lost or wasted. Surprise, the U.S. is a number one violator. This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.